All right, good day, everyone. I want to thank everyone for joining. This is the History of Zionism, Part 9, entitled The Fateful 30s. And I want to thank Becky and Avi Katz for sponsoring again Le'ilu Nishmat Yonah Ben Harav Aryeh Leib, His Neshama Should Have an Aliyah. If there's one criticism to be leveled against the Zionist movement, and it was one that Zev Jabotinsky leveled repeatedly and precipitated his departure from the movement, it's that they were too passive. And that passivity was attributable to a failure, or at least reluctance, to define their ultimate objectives. If you don't know where you're going, you'll never get there. And this problem was particularly pronounced in the 1920s, which was a lost decade, and certainly in the 1930s, which really was a decade of missed opportunities. Was the goal a state, a homeland, a refuge? Should they focus on building settlements and cities, or on political support? And if it's political support, support for what? And especially, how much should they push and clamor for increased Jewish immigration? It was Paul Johnson, the historian, who called the 20s the great missed opportunity of the decade. The Jewish population doubled from 80,000 to 160,000, but far more Arabs arrived to take advantage of the economic opportunities the Jews developed. And when the British first imposed their immigration restrictions in the early 1920s, and on Jews, only on Jews, the Zionists acquiesced. So committed was the establishment to the idea that only the British could implement the goals of the Zionists, whatever they might be. This is Johnson. During the calm years, when Israel was relatively open, the Jews would not come. It was the makings of a tragedy. When by 1929 the Jews' economic, political, and security positions began to deteriorate all over Europe, it was a little late. And he says, as their anxiety to go to Israel increased, so did the obstacles to their entering it. So it was not entirely true. Chaim Weizmann parlayed the excitement of and his critical role in securing the Balfour Declaration into the leadership of the movement, where he served as president for a decade, beginning in 1920. And it was during the 20s that the Zionist movement also officially set up shop in Israel, turning what was known as the Zionist Commission into what is today called the Jewish Agency, which still exists. It has primary responsibility for immigration, but pursuant to Weizmann's guidelines, it did not accept every Jew, and it turned down many, especially religious Jews, who were not considered good worker material. That is to say, they were craftsmen or professionals, not farmers. Weizmann put it in the bluntest sense, and I quote, "Our brothers and sisters of Jika and Nalevki," which were two districts in Warsaw, "those brothers and sisters are flesh of our flesh and blood of our blood, but we must see to it that we direct this stream and do not allow it to deflect us from our goal. It is essential to remember that we are not building our national home on the model of Jika and Nalevki." In other words, religious Jews need not apply. And indeed, some 6%, only 6% of immigration certificates in the 20s, not to mention the 30s, were allotted to religious Jews, notwithstanding there were more than half the Jewish population of Poland. So people ask, why is it that more religious Jews did not come to Israel pre-state? The answer is going to be because they were not always allowed the opportunity to come legally. And for that 6%, we would pay a terrible price, both in terms of Jews murdered in the Holocaust and in terms of the nature of the state that would be established. Most of those who arrived in the decade after World War I were socialists, ushered in by an organization created for that very purpose, called Hechalutz, which prepared Jews, that was literally Hachshara, in Poland and Germany to be farmers, and then brought them to Israel. In Israel, the pogroms of 1920 and 1921 and 1929, along with repeated harassment and incessant attacks, engendered little sympathy for the Jews on the part of the British. The police did not defend the Jews, and the police only intervened when the Jews defended themselves. And the response to the pogrom of 1929, more than 150 Jews were murdered across the country, 67 in Hebron alone. The response, the British response, was another white paper in 1930, restricting Jewish immigration even more. And this became an approach that lasted a good part of 20 years. If the Arabs rioted, then the people who had to be punished, essentially, were the Jews. Because if the Jews hadn't provoked the rioting, the Arabs would not have rioted. Unfortunately, the white paper of 1930, the Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald, was friendlier to Jews, and he rescinded the restrictions. But with hundreds of thousands of Jews seeking to leave Europe and come to Israel, the highest number in any year was the 62,000, the highest number any year in the 1930s was the 62,000 Jews that came in 1935. With new riots in 1936, the British reduced the immigration quota to 12,000, and it would stay that low and even get lower in the ensuing years. So what went wrong? When I was researching this, I was a little taken aback to realize how ineffective both Weizmann and David Ben-Gurion were. And Ben-Gurion's reputation seems based almost exclusively and justifiably on his accomplishments of the late 1940s. Before then, not much. And much of what he did in the 1930s was either ineffective or incorrect. Zev Jabotinsky first resigned from the movement in 1923 to protest Weizmann's deference to the British, which Jabotinsky considered wrong and unconscionable, and he'd leave the movement several times, including for the last time, in the middle of the 1930s. So there's no more dramatic decade than the 30s, especially in light of the catastrophe to come. So what could have been done differently? What did the Zionists do and what didn't they do? Before we get to that, we have to mention one legendary personality that came into real prominence in the 1920s, and that's Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk. Rav Kuk made Aliyah in 1904. He served as the Rav of Yafo. He spent World War I in exile in Switzerland and then Britain as a Russian subject. He was born in Latvia. The Turks did not let him re-enter. He spent the war years thinking and writing and defining the way forward to a Jewish state, to a Torah state. Rav Kuk, unlike the Zionist establishment, had no doubt that everything that was happening was part of the process of redemption. He was a unique figure. In Volozhin, where he learned for a little less than 2 years, he mastered the Hebrew language. And he encouraged, if you can mute yourself, I'd appreciate it. He encouraged the use of the Hebrew language as a Rav in Zemel and Boisk. He was attuned to the spirit of the times, and he became the religious philosopher of Zionism. Rav Kuk, alone among his contemporaries, saw not only the bad, but especially the good in the Zionists, the pioneers, those who were distant from Torah, and even mocked it. And his life's work, in a nutshell, was to provide the spiritual infrastructure for the renewed Jewish state. So he was not universally supported. Those who speak today with nostalgia about Rav Kuk and the Rabbanut and the glory days completely ignore how Rav Kuk was tormented and threatened and maligned and maledicted by his foes. And in truth, his practical successes were limited, except for his writings. He carved his own path. He found Mizrahi too pashrani, too willing to compromise. He was naturally drawn to Aguda and the Jews of the old Yishuv, but he was constantly frustrated by their indifference to the national life of the Jewish people as opposed to our spiritual life. He called them healthy souls in weak bodies, and the Chalutzim were exactly opposite. And in fact, it was the Aguda Conference in Katowice in July 1914 that forced Rav Kook to spend the war, World War I, in Europe. He'd gone in order to persuade them to take a less strident, less antagonistic approach to Zionism. Work with them, be makarev them, and not just dismiss them. But he was not heeded. In 1917, he wrote an essay and founded an organization called Degel Yerushalayim, which was intended to infuse the land with holiness. If the Zionists focused on material accomplishment, this movement would work assiduously to ensure that the spirit of Torah and holiness would infuse every aspect of life. He was mystical about Zionism in a way that few others were. And he wrote, classically, "The people of Israel are not a nation in the normal sense of the term, but rather the essence of the human ideal." Halavai, we should act like it. "The unique treasure of the land and the unique treasure of the nation suit one another. Just as the nation is unique in its divine ascent within the depth of life, so does the land of God, prepare the nation which rests upon it as an inheritance for eternity, which comes as a result of covenant. Holiness will return to its rightful place in our national Zionist movement, for only with it can we gain the source of life. And then it will revive through its power the mundane values that exist and that will exist for our support. And this will be our way of return, which will heal all our ills and will bring near the complete redemption speedily in our days. Amen." No one else wrote like that. No one else spoke like that. But Degel Yerushalayim did not succeed. And in its place, at least partly, he founded in 1924 HaYeshiva HaMerkazit HaOlamit, known shortly as Merkaz. There were very few students, but Merkaz has guided and inspired Jews for almost a century, and it still remains a force in Israeli life. Rav Kook's tzidkut and piety and learning were unsurpassed. The Gedolim of the time, even those who disagreed with Rav Kook, were deferential and even reverent, like Rav Yosef Chaim Zonenfeld, for example, who was the Rav of the Eda Charedid, who did not want to be designated Rav Yerushalayim, but whose supporters objected to Rav Kook's appointment. And Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer, and Rav Chaim Moshe Grzynski, and the Chofetz Chaim, and Rav Baruch Ber Leibovich, and Rav Hutner, etc. So their disciples were not always as courteous. And after Rav Kook died in 1935, he was much more maligned. In 1921, Rav Kook was appointed the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of the land of Israel that had been a Rishon Lezion for centuries, and many rabbis were upset, of course, for the obvious reason, it wasn't them, and because they feared having an official government institution as a rabbinate that was subject to politics, and because they feared the establishment of a Sanhedrin. But Rav Kook used the offices of the chief rabbinate to help Jews and to spread Torah, and in such a way that his successors modeled their tenure after his and all seek to claim his legacy. Another precedent was this, that still exists. The Haredi community ignored him, and they did not feel bound by his decisions, and they resented the institution of the chief rabbinate. But Rav Kook became a public figure, demanding that the British defend Jews, helping Jewish prisoners, speaking in defense of the Kotel and Jewish rights in Israel to the British, to commissions, to the press, and of course, writing voluminously. Most works were edited by his son Rav Tzvi Yehuda and published posthumously. Well, we come now to the big split. The Zionist movement, at a time when coherence and action was most imperative, instead split up. The division into different parties 100 years ago essentially duplicates what we have today. The labor Zionists dominated then. They were challenged and goaded by the revisionists. Mizrahi was a small but active part of the Zionist establishment. And on the outside, besides the secular non-Zionists, the cosmopolitan Martin Buber types, who did not want a Jewish state, and for the most part still exists today also in a different form, were the non-Zionists and sometimes the anti-Zionists of the Yishuv Hayashan, the old Yishuv. They were led by Rav Zonenfeld, and at the beginning they were not at all docile. They were active politically, but in line with their interests, they wanted separation from the Zionists. They did not share their objectives, they resented their secularism, and they did not perceive their destinies as linked. Rav Zonenfeld was quite content to live in Israel without any national rights, and the British found common cause with him, as the British also preferred the easy road of no Jewish state. Working to a Jewish state towards a Jewish homeland would always provoke the Arabs. So in fact, the negotiator for the old Yishuv, then in the early 20s, was a fascinating Jew named Yaakov Dahan, who was born in 1881 in the Netherlands into a religious family, who strayed and then returned. He was a poet and a writer. He apparently was a homosexual as well, who became interested in Zionism in his 20s. He became a Baal Tshuva, first through Mizrahi, and then after meeting Rav Zonenfeld, he became a Haredi and their spokesman, an odd choice considering his lifestyle. At one point, he offered the Arabs this deal: unlimited Jewish immigration in exchange for the Jews renouncing the Balfour Declaration. That deal he offered on behalf of the Eda Haredit. Well, the Zionists perceived him as a threat, inimical to their interests, effective, very effective, in gaining British understanding of the nuances of Jewish life. He even planned a trip to London in July 1924 to argue the case for the old Yishuv. He never made it. On June 30th, 1924, Yaakov Dahan was assassinated as he left the Shaar Tzedek Hospital Shul after davening Mincha. No one was ever arrested for the crime. The evidence, and by today it's compelling evidence, points to the Haganah as the culprit, the shooter being one Avram Tahomi, who many decades later admitted to two Israeli journalists that he did it on orders of Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, one of the leaders of the Labor Zionists, later became the second president of Israel. Tahomi said he had no regrets, as Dahan threatened to destroy the entire Zionist enterprise. And again, strangely, Tahomi, just a few years later, became one of the founders of the Irgun. But with that, the old Yishuv retreated from public negotiations and was never again a real factor in the national life of the Jewish people. They became very parochial and just sought to safeguard their interests, and that is true until today. The first, but certainly not the last, political assassination in Israel is generally forgotten, the murder of Yaakov Dahan, because the culprit was never caught, and the victim and the cause he represented were unpopular with mainstream Zionists. But, in the meantime, it soured the relationship of the Haredim and the Zionists for decades, as the Haredim had no illusions as to who ordered the hit, and they just could not compete on that level. There was another assassination that had even graver long-term implications. Chaim Arlozorov was the head of the political department of the Jewish Agency. It was a powerful position, and he's being groomed for leadership of the movement. On June 16, 1933, it's a Friday night, Arlozorov was shot and killed on the beach promenade in Tel Aviv while walking with his wife, Sima. She testified there to her assailants. Arlozorov had just returned from Germany. Hitler was in power only a few months, and Arlozorov was trying to negotiate the mass emigration of German Jews and their property in exchange for economic assistance to Germany. Arlozorov was born in Russia, but he had been raised in Germany. At the same time, Zev Jabotinsky was calling for a boycott of Germany, and so he was again at odds with the establishment, which right away, but literally immediately, sought to blame the revisionists. 2 days later, the police arrested one Avram Stavsky and charged him with homicide. A few weeks later, they arrested Zvi Rosenblatt as his accomplice, and still later arrested Abba Achimeir as the mastermind of the plot. His son, by the way, Yaakov Achimeir, is until today a well-known Israeli journalist. Jabotinsky led the defense from his perch in Europe, having been banned from Israel by the British already for a number of years. It was a long trial, after which Stavsky was convicted and sentenced to death. Zev Jabotinsky was outraged. He knew the charges were false, as did Rav Kook, who began an active and aggressive campaign to exonerate Stavsky after the sentence was passed. Stavsky appealed in June 1934. Rav Kook's campaign involved telegrams across the world to people as diverse as Stephen Wise, the Reform Rabbi in America, and the Archbishop of Canterbury. Rav Kook orchestrated public protests and wrote letters and pleaded with British officials. Even Stavsky, who was not religious, was stunned, writing to Rav Kook from prison, "I'm a plain Jew, and I wonder why have I merited it that Rav Kook concerns himself so much with my fate." 1 month later, on Erev Shabbat, which was also Erev Tisha B'Av, a British appellate court reversed his conviction on the grounds that under applicable Turkish law, one witness does not suffice in a capital case, and the only witness was Arlazarov's wife, and she herself had been equivocal in her initial testimony to the police. Stavsky was carried from prison to Merkaz Aravi, thank Rav Kook, who then told him, "Go to the Kotel and recite Tehillim," which Stavsky did. The murderers were never found, and this case came to symbolize the implacable enmity between the labor Zionists and the revisionist Zionists. It has reverberated now for almost 90 years and has become not just an example of a political assassination, but also a euphemism for charging one's political opponents with a crime in order to besmirch them. Indeed, it was Yitzhak Shamir, who had been an intelligence officer as well, besides head of the Lehi, in the heated environment that preceded the Rabin assassination in 1995, said to an aide, this is before the assassination, "They're planning another Arlazarov," something that has fueled conspiracy theorists since then. In a bizarre twist, Stavsky was killed on the Altalena in June 1948. So who killed Arlazarov has been a topic of conversation since. How did Rav Kook know he was innocent? Rav Kook said he would swear that Stavsky was innocent in front of the Aron HaKodesh on Yom HaKippurim. His son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, said only, "Sod Hashem li Rayov," God's secrets are given to those who fear him. Others claim he received confidential information from a primary source. The mystery deepened. It's really worth its own lecture, its own investigation. After Menachem Begin became the prime minister, he established a commission of inquiry, but its results were inconclusive except in establishing Stavsky's innocence. A number of theories, some bizarre theories, have surfaced. In the strangest one, it turns out that when Arlazarov was in Germany, living there in the 20s, he had a long-term relationship with a German woman named Magda. He broke it off when he moved to Israel, but he had just resumed that relationship on his just concluded visit to Germany. By this time, though, Magda was married to the evil Nazi propagandist Joseph Goebbels, who, when he learned about it, ended the life of his rival. That was one theory. Another theory follows the motive. Who had the incentive to murder Arlazarov? Well, it would be one who perceived him as a rival for leadership of the Zionist movement. You can name him if you wish. Ben-Gurion blamed the revisionists immediately, and he in fact became the leader of the movement just a year later. Thirdly, and most prosaically, and who knows, he was murdered by Arabs. Indeed, an Arab imprisoned on another murder, while Stavsky was in prison, confessed to the crime. Even before the trial, He gave details that only someone there would have known. And in fact, Sima Arlazarov had first told the police that her husband Chaim was shot by Arabs. But this Arab's confession was retracted under pressure from Arab notables who visited him in prison. For his own part, on his deathbed, Chaim Arlazarov told the police he did not believe the assailants were Jews. We'll never know, but the legacy of distrust endures. Well, there is an immediate and a lasting consequence. In the Zionist elections, the summer of 1933, just 2 months after the assassination, the revisionists had been growing in popularity in Europe, and they anticipated receiving as much as half the vote, making them a real rival to the Labor Zionists. With the Arlazarov accusations, their popularity dropped, and they barely received 15% of the vote. They would not achieve any measure of popularity again until 1977, when the Likud was elected the largest party in Israel. The Arlazarov case thus had a major and a long-term impact. Despairing of achieving anything through the establishment, Zev Jabotinsky established in 1935 what he called the New Zionist Organization, breaking away from the Zionist organization, protesting both the Zionist organization's passivity, its pro-British stance, and its socialism. And in this, he saw his new organization as the natural successors to Herzl and Nordau, advocates of political Zionism. Jabotinsky rejected class struggle as having any connection to Zionism, which by this point, the socialists, the labor Zionists, had made almost the framework of Zionism, that they saw Zionism as part of the worldwide worker struggle. And to Jabotinsky, that played a huge role in the concessionary nature of the Zionist movement. If you're part of One World Socialist International, there's a limit to how much you can push for without running afoul of the other objectives of that movement. Jabotinsky was clear in his goals: immigration, a Jewish army, settlement, self-help, statehood. And he held, as we discussed last time, the Arab question would resolve itself over decades through the iron wall of Jewish strength. He wrote already in 1924, "The program is not complicated. The aim of Zionism is a Jewish state. The territory, both sides of the Jordan. The system, mass colonization. The solution, the financial problem, a national loan." Yeah, international assistance was needed, hence the commandment of the hour, a new political campaign, and the militarization of Jewish youth in Eretz Yisrael and the diaspora. At least people knew where he stood and where he was going. The establishment was always treading water and biding their time. It's interesting that at least part of Arlazarov's vision and his last mission bore fruit. In the 1930s, more than half of German Jews emigrated, leaving Germany. 60,000 of them came to Israel with their jackets and most of their wealth, and they contributed greatly to the culture of the nascent Jewish homeland, much different than the Polish and Russian Jews and from the Edorim Mizrach. So in Germany, from 523,000 German Jews in 1933, by the time the war started 6 years later, only 220,000 Jews lived in Germany, meaning more than 300,000, more than 60% left. And about 165,000 German Jews were murdered in the Holocaust. So there were one-fifth of the Jews who fled, came to Israel. They were more welcomed than the Jews of Poland. And ironically, it was German Jews who knew of Hitler before most. They had a relatively low death rate during the Holocaust. Of course, granted, each life is precious. In retrospect, the 30s were a lost and deadly decade because the Zionist movement was victimized by internecine conflict an inability to articulate goals and a means to achieve them, and amongst the officialdom, a slavish obeisance to the British. Here we come to David Ben-Gurion, who became the head of the Jewish Agency in 1935, and in that post, the most powerful individual in the Zionist movement. So as noted, his justified acclaim comes from what he did to found the state in the late 1940s, and how he established the institutions and the political culture of the state that to some extent still exists, although fading. But in the 1930s, he was not successful, and he did little to advance the prospects of a Jewish state and even impeded it. David Grin was born in Płońsk in 1886, part of Polish Russia. His father, Avigdor, was an early Zionist, even founding a Zionist club in Płońsk after Der Judenstaat was published in 1896. He learned Hebrew as a youth, but all his formal education ended with his bar mitzvah. And yet, as you know, Ben-Gurion was an autodidact, a voracious reader. You visit his homes in Tel Aviv, or Sde Boker, and you see most of the walls are books, and in a variety of languages also. See, he made Aliyah in 1906, age 20. He said, in fact, once that Płońsk had the highest rate of Aliyah of any town in Poland, and he became an active socialist. As a farmer for a short time, then an editor, he first fought for the Ottomans in World War I, and then he served in the Jewish Legion, then he studied law in Turkey. His father forged a high school graduation certificate. He never graduated high school. And Ben-Gurion returned to Israel in 1919, where in due course he became one of the founders and leaders of the Histadrut, which became his main source of support and a weapon that he wielded against non-socialists like Jabotinsky and the revisionists, to whom he denied membership. And along with that, deny membership of the Histadrut, you're denied health care and a job and loans and sometimes even education. In the 1930s, there were pitched battles in the streets between the labor Zionists and the revisionists in the land of Israel. There were arrests, there was sabotage that only stopped when Ben-Gurion and Zev Jabotinsky met in London to arrange a truce. Ben-Gurion, as the Jewish Agency chief, and like Weizmann, acquiesced to the biased immigration policies of the British. Jewish immigration was severely restricted. Certificates were difficult to obtain, and in the mid-1930s, the British even began monitoring the arrival of tourists, even arresting some, to ensure that no one overstayed their welcome. If the British were suspicious, they detained anybody. And the Zionist establishment issued mild and feeble protests, but felt itself powerless to do anything about it. Jabotinsky insisted on public demonstrations, pressure in London, public pressure against the government, but again he was marginalized by the establishment that felt currying favor with the British and working behind the scenes was more important. And Jabotinsky said again and again, if you feel yourself powerless, you are powerless. If you feel yourself powerful, you are powerful. The British had several objectives, and none of them involved the creation of a Jewish state. One was to promote stability, and stability is achieved then and now by placating those most prone to violence, to wit, the Arabs. Second, and in line with the need for stability, was to restrict Jewish immigration and any path to statehood. And truth be told, some Brits, including many posted here, and some in the government back in London, were out-and-out Jew haters, and they did little to disguise it, and part of that Jew hatred included harsh measures to prevent Jewish self-defense. When Arab riots resumed in force in 1936, they objected to the immigration laws that had allowed 60,000 Jews to immigrate that year, exceeding the quota even. Ben-Gurion propagated his notion of havlaga, restraint, not responding to every attack, which he felt would only encourage more attacks and also provoke the British. It was weakness masquerading as strength, something that recurred here in Israel in the 1990s and early 2000s as well. But it also offends common sense and justice and decency, and it demoralizes the citizenry that suffers death, injury, and loss that goes unrequited and therefore undeterred. Jabotinsky was apoplectic, and this havlaga led directly to the recreation of the military force, the Irgun Tzva'i Lumi, the Etzel. It had been founded 5 years earlier, like I mentioned, Avram Tahomi was one of the founders, but it fell apart with most rejoining the Haganah. It was recreated in 1936. David Raziel soon after became the head of it. Jabotinsky was the nominal head, although he was rarely involved, and he did not want to be consulted about operations. After all, he wasn't in the land of Israel. Ben-Gurion, of course, hated it, and he was particularly agitated by its encroachment on his monopoly of authority, if not power, as well as its tactics. What were its early tactics? Well, the Etzel did not limit itself to defense, but responded to bombs in Jewish buses and markets with bombs in Arab buses and markets. In one of these revenge attacks, an unsuccessful one, on March 28, 1938, three Jews were arrested by the British, including Shlomo ben Yosef. They were all members of Beitar from Rosh Pina. In a controversial move that had grave repercussions, Ben Yosef was hanged by the British 3 months later. He wrote from prison to his mother, "Klum ein li, klum eini rotze bishvili. I have nothing, I want nothing for myself. Hakol la'am, la'am Yisrael. Everything for the people of Israel." His mother was still back in Europe. He wrote to Zev Jabotinsky, "I promise you my last promise, Shani Eilech Litlaya Barosh Zakuf Kamo Beitari. I'm going to walk to my hanging with my head held high, just like a Beitarnik. Va'ani amutim shimcha shekokach yakarli al svatai. I will die with your name that is so precious to me on my lips." And indeed, on the way to the gallows, Ben Yosef sang Beitar hymns, ending with the cry, "Yichi HaMedina HaYehudit, Yichi Jabotinsky." Ben-Gurion, too, labored to avoid the execution because he deemed it too severe. After all, it was an attempted terrorist attack. No one had been killed. Jews across the world were outraged. Tens of thousands of East European Jews fasted as ordained by the rabbis. Ben Yosef's mother back in Lutsk was given a lifetime pension by Beitar, and she was brought to Israel. The British consulate in Amsterdam was attacked, and Ben Yosef's British hangman was eventually killed by the Lehi in 1942. And if anything, the Etzel's efforts were redoubled. So the moralists argue as to the propriety of giving the terrorists a taste of their own medicine, and some even question the efficacy of the tactics. However you look at it, the Arab terror revolt ended shortly thereafter. But the dispute between the socialists and the revisionists never healed, although it was put on pause during the war, World War II, and for a year or so thereafter. It is the great fissure in Israeli political life that has only cooled because the socialists have dramatically declined in influence and popular support. Meanwhile, the British responded to the riots and the mayhem in the Arab revolt of 36, 37, 38 by forming another commission, a royal commission, popularly called the Peel Commission, to investigate the root causes of the strife that had led to violence and a general Arab strike. I note, Agavurcha, investigating root causes is what politicians do when they have no answers and they're just seeking to kick the can down the road. So the commission met in Israel. It met in London, where Jabotinsky testified. In Israel, Weizmann said that for Europe's Jews, I quote, "the world is divided into places where they cannot live and places where they cannot enter." And that was a true statement. And mind you, this is already the middle of 1938, a little over a year before World War II started. Ben-Gurion testified as well. He didn't ask for a state, though. Neither did Weizmann, for that matter. But they asked for immigration to save European Jewry. And there was this famous colloquy that occurred at the end. It was written up by Rav Yisrael Meir Lau in one of his books. Lord Peel said, "Mr. Ben-Gurion, may I ask you a question?" "Of course you can. That's why I'm here," replied Ben-Gurion. "Where are you born?" Ben-Gurion answered, "Płońsk." "Where is Płońsk?" "Poland." A large period of silence came after the reply. Finally, Lord Peel said in the barest whisper, "Very strange indeed. All of the Arab leaders who have appeared before me were born in Palestine. Most of the Jewish leaders who have appeared before me were born in Eastern Europe." Lord Peel continued, "Mr. Ben-Gurion, the Arab people have a Kushan, it's an Ottoman land deed, entitling them to this land. Do you have a document saying that Palestine belongs to you?" At that point, Ben-Gurion became aware of the Tanakh that he swore upon while taking the oath to be a witness to the commission, and he held up the Tanakh triumphantly, exclaiming, "Here's your Kushan, here is your document. It is the world's most highly respected book, and I believe that you British regard it with much respect too. We must have this land." As Rav Lau continued the story, in 1972, he went to see if the story was true. Ben-Gurion said, "Emet v'yatziv," it's exactly what happened. Rav Lau said to Ben-Gurion, "If you would take the Kushan and trample it and crumple it up and tear off parts of it, could use it as proof?" Meaning, if the Jewish people disregard most of the Torah, then how can you use the Torah as proof of our entitlement to the land? Ben-Gurion had no answer for that. Jabotinsky testified in London before the commission in February 1937. He accused the British of walking away from the Balfour Declaration and literally of letting the Arabs get away with murder. And he accused the British of artificially suppressing the Jewish population and then claiming the Jews are not entitled to an independent state because they're not the majority. By the way, something we've heard now in Hebron for 40 years. How could Hebron be under Jewish sovereignty when only 1,000 Jews live there? Of course, the reason only 1,000 Jews live there is because the government never let more Jews live there. So it's a bit artificial, even farcical. Jabotinsky said the minimum Jews would accept is a state that could house millions of Jews who had to flee Europe. In the end, it was a waste, the Peel Commission. It was just a prelude to another commission a year later. The Peel Commission did conclude that the mandate was unworkable and recommended partition, giving the Jews land in the Galil and a sliver along the coast. And that's it. Roughly 20% of the land of Israel west of the Jordan. Even the partition of 47, certainly the boundaries after the 48 war, gave Israel much greater territory. Reluctantly, the Zionists, but not Jabotinsky, accepted partition, and that would also be a pattern. Contemptuously, the Arabs dismissed it, even though they would have had 80% of the country. Jabotinsky called such land a pale of settlement in the land of Israel. And now he proposed the immigration of 150,000 Jews a year, so that in 4 years, Jews would be the majority. 1 million over 7 years. Weizmann spoke of 1 million over 25 to 30 years, lamenting, this is 1938, that most Jews would perish in Europe. The Peel Commission recommended a maximum of 12,000 Jews per year. And meanwhile, in his testimony, Ben-Gurion still insisted that the goal of the Jewish agency was not a state, but a national home. And this confusion, this indecision, would also prove costly. The Jews did not know what they wanted. The Arabs knew what they wanted. No Jews. At the same time, Jabotinsky had a sense of impending doom for European Jewry that he began writing and speaking about across Europe and elsewhere already in the early 1930s. In fact, in 1934, Zev Jabotinsky got 600,000 European Jews to sign an open letter petitioning the civilized world to demand the gates of Israel be open to Jews in light of the deteriorating situation in Europe. Not much came of it, although the numbers alone reveal the level of support that he had and the awareness of Jews in Europe that something was not right. In 1936, Jabotinsky proposed an evacuation plan for the Jews of Poland, Hungary, and Romania to the land of Israel. The three governments nominally agreed, as they didn't want the Jews there anyway, but Jewish leaders objected, saying that this plan just played into the hands of Jew haters who felt that Jews had dual loyalty, and the fact that the Polish government endorsed the plan was to them an indication of how repugnant the plan was. The World Zionist Organization, led by Weizmann, the Jewish agency led by Ben-Gurion, opposed it, and the British vetoed it, and the plan died. In 1938, Jabotinsky traveled throughout Poland telling the Jews, I quote, "They're living on the edge of a volcano," end quote, and they ignored him. This is not to blame those who did not heed him, and certainly not to mitigate the dreadful evil perpetrated against the Jewish people in the Holocaust. In retrospect, of course, Jabotinsky was right. But to many people, his plan sounded like an absurd overreaction. Nonetheless, there was a window of opportunity to avert this gruesome catastrophe, and most Jews did not avail themselves of it. Not being able to perceive harmful trends is a common and understandable human tendency. We assume the status quo will continue indefinitely because it usually does, until it doesn't. And compounding the problem was, if they wanted to leave, where would they go? Since they couldn't go to Israel, they couldn't go to America. Where would they go? Jabotinsky's words and speeches were remarkable. He traveled across the world, then to Europe and South Africa, America. He was a cry in the wilderness, the prophet of doom, whose dire prophecies came to pass. And now the walls were closing around the Jews. After the Anschluss, the Americans called the Evian Conference to deal with the plight of the Jewish refugees, but it was all a show. No Jews were invited, and the land of Israel was not allowed on the agenda. It was an exercise in political phoniness, motion without action. But what could be done? The then head of Beitar in Poland, Menachem Begin, called for military action to take the land, and he was shot down by Jabotinsky, who called his words and the applause they generated prattle. Jabotinsky pointed out, "We're not in the land in any numbers. Most of the potential fighters are in Europe and they can't get to Israel. And the Arabs are more numerous and can count on the support of the surrounding Arabs." But they did raise money to arm the Irgun. In August 1938, Jabotinsky gave his most impassioned speech yet, addressing the Jews of Poland in one of the shuls on Tisha B'Av. I quote, "For 3 years, I have been imploring you, Jews of Poland, the crown of world Jewry, appealing to you, warning you unceasingly that the catastrophe is nigh. My hair has turned white, and I have grown old over these years, for my heart is bleeding that you, dear brothers and sisters, do not see the volcano which will soon begin to spew forth its fire of destruction. I see a horrible vision. Time is growing short for you to be spared. I know you cannot see it, for you are troubled and confused by everyday concerns. Listen to my words at this 12th hour. For God's sake, let everyone save himself so long as there is time to do so, for time is running short. And I want to say something else to you on this day, the 9th of Av. Those who will succeed in escaping the catastrophe will live to experience a festive moment of great Jewish joy, the rebirth and establishment of the Jewish state. I do not know whether I myself will live to see it, but my son will. I am certain of this, just as I am certain that the sun will rise tomorrow morning. I believe in it with all my heart." He was right about that too, and the painful question remains, what could be done? Emigration from Europe was cut off. The British had effectively closed the land of Israel, and when they promulgated another white paper in May 1939, a total of 75,000 Jews to Israel over 5 years, and then nothing, the noose was tightened even further. And then the war erupted in September when Nazi Germany invaded Poland. Millions of Jews became refugees overnight with almost no place to go. Zev Jabotinsky visited the United States in order to create, among other things, to create a Jewish army to fight the Nazis, similar to what he had done with the Jewish Legion in World War I. He traveled to the Beitar camp in upstate New York, in Hunter, New York, where he suddenly took ill, saying what became his last words, "I'm so tired, I'm so tired." 2 hours later, he was dead of heart failure. August 3rd, 1940, the 29th of Tammuz, a few months shy of his 60th birthday. He was buried in the New Montefiore Cemetery in Farmingdale. You can see a plaque there commemorates his old grave. Having given instructions, he was to be buried in Israel only under a sovereign Jewish state. And that he was, but not until 1964, as Ben-Gurion, his foe, did not allow him to be reburied while he was prime minister. It was Levi Eshkol who had Jabotinsky reinterred on Har Herzl among the founders of the nation. When Jabotinsky died, Rav Herzog eulogized him as a miraculous personality. Even his enemies praised him, and 25,000 Jews accompanied his casket to New Montefiore. Many Jews in the new ghettos in Europe refused to believe that Jabotinsky was dead. And now the great catastrophe unfolded. The Zionist response to the Holocaust and the establishment of the state will come next in the final installment of the history of Zionism. I thank you all very much.